This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. The work of the Beat Poets helped define a generation. Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Getty, Diane DePrima. These are some of the poets who spoke the language of the streets and changed the rules about what poetry was and was not. It was a generation closely associated with the 1950s and mostly thought to have been replaced by the hippie movement of the 60s. But poet and author Thomas Rain Crowe was in San Francisco in the 1970s, and he became part of a group dubbed the Baby Beats. They were the young, budding writers fascinated with the beat era who helped resurrect the art form. In the book, Starting from San Francisco, The Baby Beat Generation and the Second San Francisco Renaissance, Thomas Rain Crowe shares stories of what it was like to be kicking around in San Francisco with his heroes as he pursued the life of a poet. Thomas Rain Crowe joins us now from Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. Hello, Thomas.
Hey there. I've been hoping that we might have a conversation someday, and here we are.
Here we are doing it. You're from that part of the country and made your way out to San Francisco. Talk about what drew you to San Francisco.
Well, essentially, the story goes is that I graduated from college at Furman University, and I went straight to France. I thought that to be a great poet, you had to be French, and I was in love with the French surrealist painters and also the French poets, and I'd studied French in school so I could speak it and read it. But people like Rimbaud and Apollinaire and Gall, Prévert were all some of my favorite poets. So I went to France as an expatriate and thinking I'd be there and would be a French poet someday. But that didn't work out. I was only going to be a wannabe poet in France. So I came back and I went to where the action is, which is San Francisco, and to be around people whose poetry and whose work I admired and were some of my literary heroes in high school and growing up. So I stuck out my thumb and got there.
What year was this?
This was 1973.
So at this moment, we're sort of at the tail end of the hippie movement in San Francisco, and certainly about 10 years out from what we think of as the end of the beat generation and the beats. What were you expecting to find when you got to San Francisco in 73?
Well, I really didn't know what I was going to find. I went to the source, which was City Lights Books, and walked in the door of the publishing house, and there was Lawrence Ferlinghetti putting a painting on the wall. Lawrence was my hero. He really opened the doors of perception to me as a poet when I was young, and allowed me to be able to write in, you know, common vernacular and everyday speech, and which was not something that I had been taught in school. But there he was, and he was trying to put a picture on the wall. I walked in the door, the bell rang, and he looked around and motioned to me to come over and help him put this picture on the wall. And that's how it started for me. And I ended up giving them a manuscript of poems I'd written in France while I was living there for about a year. And he looked at it and eventually returned it. They did not publish it, but that was the beginning of my relationship and conversations with Ferlinghetti.
He said, not only is this not vernacular, it's French. No, I'm sorry.
That's right. Well, he had a long history of associations and time in France, so yeah. I knew that there was that connection. So
talk about your fascination again with these poets of the Beat Generation. I mean, we're talking about Brodigan here, Bukowski, Corso, all of these poets who had been associated with this really groundbreaking movement, who, as you say, break all the rules that we had known about poetry. Stop making references to Greek myths, for God's sake. We don't know what you're talking about, and let's use English and that sort of thing. And it really did open all new possibilities for writers of all stripes in that era. But things had moved on since then. Who was still around, and what was your next step after you got that picture hung?
Well, yeah, the 60s revolution, so to speak, was pretty much over by then, and there was a whole new vibe in San Francisco. The Haight-Ashbury was starting to become gentrified, and the hippies had moved to the northeast, up north, and so... But basically, everybody was just hanging out and in the cafes in North Beach, and that's where all the action was, and that's really why the moniker of the University of the Streets, where it came from. We were literally hanging out with all the people you mentioned and more. Those are the usual suspects, but there were many, many more beat writers who were in San Francisco in those years that a lot of people don't know about. And everybody was in the cafes and bars, and that's where we were exchanging ideas and poems and things like that.
And talk about the revival, too, and your friendship with Neely Cherkovsky and the revival, bringing Beatitude magazine back, which was published at that time out of City Lights. Talk about bringing all that stuff back.
Right. Well, a bunch of us were hanging out with Harold Norris. He was doing a Friday night workshop, and there was a bunch of us younger poets. We were mostly all in our 20s, mid-20s, and during one of those Friday night classes, as we called it, somebody came up with the idea to resurrect Beatitude magazine. And so, you know, being naive and energetic at that age, we said, sure, why not? And we did. We went and talked to Lawrence and Bob Kaufman, who was around, who was one of the founders, and Brodigan was living in North Beach. All these people that had a history with the original magazine, which is where the Beats first got their start in terms of being published, a mimeograph revolution of the 50s, we did. We resurrected the magazine and started Beatitude 21 and kept doing it, you know, as often as we could. It was very loose, rotating editorship type of a system. But it happened.
You talk about Bob Kaufman, one of the co-founders of Beatitude. Again, as you say, the sort of the literary, mimeographed literary Bible of the Beat generation, right? Or at least the record. And he's the guy who is credited, at least, with coining the term beatnik, Kaufman was. But at the point that you met him, I think he was, he had broken his vow of silence by 73, right?
No, he's still walking around, you know, just basically being silent. I mean, he would utter certain words and phrases, but not really ever engaging in conversation. It wasn't until about 1974, 75 when he finally broke his silence. And I happened to be there the moment he did that. And he jumped up on a table in Malvina's Coffee House and started reciting poetry for about 20 or 25 mm-hmm. minutes. And everybody, you know, just jaws dropped. And that was the beginning. And the first event that we organized was a reading for Bob Kaufman. And nobody had heard him read in 12 or 13 years. And we packed the place, and there were people in the streets wanting to hear Bob after all those years.
And talk, of course, this is a vow he took after John Kennedy was assassinated in 1963. And as you say, something he maintained for a good 10 years, 12 years. So talk about the reception. Again, Beatitude comes back. You're holding readings. You're resurrecting. For some, Bob Kaufman, they hadn't heard him, but some of the other Beat poets hadn't heard them in a while. What kind of reception were you getting?
Well, it started off with that reading, and it was a small venue, but like I said, it was packed out. So we did a couple more small readings of Beatitude Benefits, and we joined and did some readings with City Lights Bookstore. But they were all packed, and people weren't getting into the reading, so we had to find bigger spaces to do this. So we went down and talked to Coppola at Zoetrope Theater Studios and rented his little theater space because it was bigger. And we packed out that place. We had people in the streets. We'd have somebody read inside. They go outside, stand on top of a car in the street and read to the people in the street. So we kept having to get bigger and bigger. I mean, the audiences and the word kept spreading that the Beats are back, you know, and it was them and the younger generation of poets, you know, my friends. And eventually it led to one afternoon sitting in the in Malvina's, no, it was in the Savoy Tivoli, I think, with Ferlinghetti and Neely and myself and Peter LeBlanc. And Lawrence turns to me and he says, what we need to do is have a poetry festival here in San Francisco. And he looked at me and says, what do you think? And I said, sure. You know, and so we went on a rampage to try to figure out how we were going to do that. And we eventually got the Veterans Auditorium down next to the Opera House, which seats 3,000 people, organized this big festival for two nights. packed out the Veterans Auditorium, which seats 3,000 people. We had people in the aisles and on stage. I mean, the audience for poetry and to see the Beats again and this younger poets was ever escalating and was amazing.
Talk about this term "Baby Beats" and how it was coined, because there's a hint of derision in its original use with one of the Beat poets who didn't sound like he was so happy for the attention he was getting. If I read you right.
No, that's true. I was there too. Richard Brautigan was always and often in the bars and cafes. And so one night we were in Speck's bar late at night, and we walked in there, me and my friend Ken Wenio and Larry Sparks, and there was Brautigan sitting with John Logan in the back of Speck's bar talking. And so we went back there, and John Logan, great American poet, and he was very happy to see us. He asked us to come sit down. And obviously Brautigan wanted him all to himself. And so the epithet that came out of Brautigan's mouth at that moment was, "You don't want to waste your time with these kids. They're nothing but baby Beats." and the epithet stuck, and one of the cultural writers for the San Francisco Examiner picked up on it and coined that term for us younger generation of poets, and it stuck. And we've kind of been riding that train ever since.
You found, you and others, I guess, came across a trove of letters that would have been so wonderful had it ever been published. Talk about the book that was supposed to be Letters of the Beat Generation. Tell me that story.
Oh, well, that's a sad story for Thomas Crow, because Neely and I were best friends. We still are. And he was writing a biography on Lawrence Ferlinghetti for Doubleday. And I was helping him on the side. And we would go over to Berkeley to the Special Collections Library, and we'd go through all the City Lights archive and digging up stuff, trying to, you know, write this biography. And I got fascinated with the letters and all the letters from the Beat Generation going back to the 50s, which included everybody you could name of any importance during that time, were there. I mean, just boxes and boxes of them. And I started reading them and collecting them and making copies, and eventually became a manuscript that I submitted to City Lights that they accepted. And they set a publication date, and they put out publicity. And I was all ready to go. It would be my first book. It would have put me on the map. It would have opened doors for me in terms of my young career. But then all of a sudden, it disappeared. The book never came out. Nobody could explain to me what had happened. Nobody knew where the manuscript was. And that story has gone on just like that for the last 45 years. I'm still trying to find that manuscript.
Because you didn't keep a copy, did you?
No, I didn't. That was my mistake, my young, naive self.
What do you remember about that? I mean, what are some of the stories and perhaps a letter or two that may have been the reason that never saw the light of day? But if you don't want to speculate on that, give us an insight in some of the more interesting findings that you discovered among those letters.
Well, I did make some inquiries. I wrote to Allen and Ginsberg, and I wrote to Nancy Joyce Peters, and I've written to Lawrence. And over the years, you know, I've tried to. I know the people that work at City Lights Publishing and at the bookstore, and nobody seems to know. At least they're not talking. And my feeling is those letters were so revealing about who these people were. We're talking about Kerouac and Burroughs and Corso and Rexroth and all the luminaries from that Beat Generation, and these really revealing letters in terms of their personalities, of their psychology, their lesser nature, you may say. And I think that was the reason. And I have a feeling that Allen Ginsberg had something to do with why that book never came out. He did not want him and his friends to be revealed in the way that those letters would have revealed.
Well, so give us an example from what you remember, something they might not want us to know.
Well, it's been a long time since I've seen those letters, so I can't really remember verbatim, but it's just there's personality traits. Like Gregory Corso was always begging for money and always angry at somebody about something that they hadn't done, which they probably had done. That kind of thing. And the Kerouac letters were, some of them were from down in Big Sur when he was staying in Ferlinghetti's cabin in Big Sur when he wrote the novel Big Sur. And he was on the verge of suicide. And the letters were long, the 6 or 7 page letters, just pouring his soul out on the paper, you know, almost saying that he was going to do himself in at any minute. And beautiful letters, but it was revealing. And this is a side of Kerouac that's not been written about very much, and people just didn't know. People know that he, you know, had a drinking problem, but the drinking problem was expanded into, you know, a larger problem that he had.
Well, so tell us about the legacy of the Beat Poets and what we should know and how, you know, the genealogy, where is it today? How do we see it today?
Well, that's really the reason for this book. The book isn't about me. It's about the Renaissance. It's the biggest Renaissance, literary Renaissance, that's ever happened in this country, and that it's important for that reason. But beyond that, it chronicles the passing of the baton from one generation to the other, in terms of the Beat literary tradition. And so it's documented with pictures and stories and information about particular people and places and things that happened. And it also says that now it's in its third generation, because some of us that are now approaching 70 or beyond 70 are mentoring young poets in the same tradition, in the same ways that we were mentored in San Francisco. It's a university of the streets. These days, we do it through email a lot. I'm corresponding with a young poet in Scotland by email, and we're sharing poems and talking about things. So
it's still happening. It's still going on. Thomas Rain Crowe is a poet and author. His adventures are chronicled in a book, Starting from San Francisco, The Baby Beat Generation and the Second San Francisco Renaissance. Thomas, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. And let me just mention, too, that people can get the book by going to the website for Third Mind Books.
And to our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by North Carolina Public Radio, which is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.